It's a Boston sports hangover after a big day for the Pats, Sox, and Bruins. But the weekend is just starting. It's Friday, October 6, 2017. I'm Chris Gasper, and this is Season Ticket. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm joined by Boston Globe sports writer Chad Finn. Chad, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Chris?
Did you recover from last night? How's your remote control thumb? Mine's a little sore.
You know what? I got to admit, I kind of skipped on the Bruins. I had to get that score this morning. So I was from 4 to midnight, you're booked up with the Red Sox and Patriots. At least I was.
It was a lot of fun, except for the Red Sox and that outcome. Obviously, they lost Game 1 of the American League Division Series to the Houston Astros by a score of 8-2. Not a great outing for ace Chris Sale. It was sort of reminiscent of last year when they opened up against the Indians and Rick Porcello didn't pitch well in that game. He gave up 5 earned runs. Porcello did. It was 7 for Chris Sale. Sale served up 3 home runs. He only lasted 5-plus innings, allowed 9 hits. The question here is, does Chris Sale deserve some sort of special dispensation because it's his first playoff start versus a guy like David Price, who all we heard last year was it didn't matter that he won 17 games. It didn't matter that he's a Cy Young Award winner. He was brought to Boston for one thing and one thing only, to come up big in the playoffs, a la a Curt Schilling. Well, now that Sale didn't do it, does he get held to the same standard?
That's how you make your reputation in Boston, especially since 2004, when they actually won a World Series for the first time in 86 years. It's by pitching well in the postseason. When you have that reputation as a guy who fronts the staff, you got to do that in October as well. John Lester did it. Curt Schilling did it. Josh Beckett did it, who's kind of forgotten a little
bit. It's a great point.
Was terrific in big games. David Price, the difference between David Price and Chris Sale here, I think, is that this was Sale's first postseason start of his career. He's an incredibly accomplished pitcher, but he hasn't done it on good teams until this season. Price has been generally brutal in the playoffs. He's 2-8, and the 2 wins came in relief. So there was sort of an expectation there, a little bit more weight on him there, that this guy hasn't pitched well in the playoffs. He needs to start doing this now, especially based on what we're paying him. Whereas with Chris Sale, it's kind of, okay, let's see what he can do in the postseason.
Here's my concern on Sale, and there's no question he had a great season. You can make an argument that he's the Cy Young Award winner in the American League. I think it's between Sale and Corey Kluber. You could go either way. But there clearly was a trend here as we got up to October and through the series of Sale not pitching as well, of his performance being diminished. If you go back to August 1, and I'm including the start he made in Game 1 against the Astros here, you look at that. It's 12 starts. He's 4-5. It's a 4.69 ERA. He's allowed 71 hits and 71 innings pitched. That's not Chris Sale. That's not the dominant Chris Sale we saw before. And this is a trend for him throughout his career. September, October, you look at his splits, that's the only sort of split of months where he has a losing record. In the regular season in those months, he's 11-16 with the 3.78 ERA. Did the Red Sox ignore these red flags about Chris Sale and the idea that he's a guy that, as you get towards the end of the season, he becomes less effective and less durable?
In a macro sense, I don't think they did. In a micro sense, they did. He faced 851 batters this year. That didn't lead the American League, but he led the American League in innings pitched. He led the American League in strikeouts, which means he threw a lot of pitches. And this is a guy who did have that history of pitching at this extraordinary level for the first few months and then just sort of being good the rest of the season. So they should have known when they brought him in here that maybe we need to be cautious along the way a little bit. If he's got 10 strikeouts in 6 innings, don't bring him out there for the 7th if you're up 3 or 4 runs.
So you're saying that in Baltimore they shouldn't have brought him back out to get that 300 strikeout?
I feel like that's one we're going to be talking about down the road, yeah.
One strike away for the tall lefty, and here comes the 2-2. He struck him out! 300 strikeouts for Chris Sale! Just the second pitcher in Red Sox history to achieve it.
He pitched 8 innings that day, which probably wasn't necessary. He is a guy who has that history, so they need to be aware of this. I think they will be going forward, but it's too bad that it seems to have taken it coming back to bite them right now.
Yeah, and look, Sale is, as they say in baseball parlance, a gamer. I mean, he's never going to turn down the ball or a start. So, it's not to put it on him. And if you look at his frame, I mean, he's 6'6", but he has a very slight frame. And it's he doesn't have, you mentioned John Lester. I mean, that's a guy who's very thick. He's somebody who was built for 162 and then the postseason. You look at Sale, he has, like I said, his frame is a little bit frail. And you look at that and wonder, do you have to sort of handle him differently, treat him differently if you're the Red Sox, sort of preserve him for the postseason? Because there's enough evidence now in Chris Sale's career that he tends to fade as the season goes on. And that's something you have to manage if you're a team like the Red Sox that's built to win in October, because ultimately that's what you're going to be judged on. And fair or not, that's what Sale's going to be judged on, is what he does in October.
Yeah, you mentioned it too. The alarming thing is, since August 1st, is the home runs he's allowed. I think it was 13 in the regular season and 66 innings.
You're right.
And three more yesterday.
You're absolutely correct. It's 16 since August 1st.
That's incredible. I mean, for a bad pitcher, that is a lot of home runs to give up in 2 months of the season. For a pitcher of Chris Sale's ability, it's alarming. And I think what we found out, and they should have known this, I understand the temptation to leave him out there. He's a fantastic pitcher. Of course, you want to leave him in the game. But what we need to know, what they've learned and what they need to do going forward here with Chris Sale the next couple seasons, is when you have an opportunity to rest him, skip a start, do it. Do what they did with Pedro Martinez in his heyday. When you're ahead 7-2 in the seventh inning, don't send Chris Sale out there to get his double-digit strikeout. Get him that extra inning or two, that extra 20 or 30 pitches of rest. That adds up. Maybe that means he's going to be a better pitcher later in the season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one way. But it's too late now. I mean, you can't worry about it now. And here's the thing. If the Red Sox ultimately win this series, I think Chris Sale will be a big part of it, whether it's coming back in game four and pitching on 3 days rest, which obviously would be antithetical to everything we just talked about in terms of you have to get this guy rest and you have to handle him with care a little bit, or coming back in a decisive game five and pitching. So looking at it moving forward, Chris Sale, hopefully, if you're the Red Sox, will get another chance to pitch in this series and to make his mark in the postseason.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. I mean, they wouldn't have done this because he's far and away their best pitcher, I think, in terms of perception and over the course of the full season. But you watch what Cleveland did against the Yankees, where Trevor Bauer started game one, a guy who, great second half, but not a long track record in the major leagues. Suddenly, they win that first game. They've got Corey Kluber, who probably is going to win the Cy Young Award. It's going to be close between him and Sale. They're up one against the Yankees with Corey Kluber going in game two. You almost wonder if the Red Sox maybe should have done something like that. I don't think they would, because there was such a gap between Sale and everybody else on the staff other than maybe Pomerantz. But it was a pretty bold move Cleveland made. Red Sox might be in a different situation if they had done the same thing.
I think it's a little unfair to put all of what happened in game one on Chris Sale. Honestly, game one was a disaster from the outset for the Red Sox. And looking at the rest of the series, you wonder if there are repercussions. Eduardo Nunez, who we had not seen in a while, had struggled with the knee injury, tried to come back in this game, and didn't last very long.
Swings on the first one, chops it to Bregman. He's got it, two out. And Nunez is down in a heap.
Whoa.
Yeah, the thing with Nunez is he was originally injured on September 9th. Hurt his knee, came back, clearly wasn't ready when he came back. I don't remember the date of that one game, but he didn't make it through the full game. Then he talks his way. It seems like he talked his way onto the playoff roster.
Well, they had the simulated game for him Monday.
Yeah, simulated games always tell you exactly what you need to know, right? They put him in a two spot in the lineup, and he didn't get out. He didn't survive the first inning. So I'm kind of wondering what made them think this guy was ready to go and healthy, because there haven't been any signs that we've seen that he was somebody who was going to be able to hold up through the postseason, let alone through the first inning of the first game.
I think that's just one of many second guesses you could make about the Red Sox, Chad, and their playoff roster. I'll tell you one. For me, they had the second best bullpen ERA in baseball behind Cleveland this year. It was 3.15.
Yeah.
But a lot of the guys who built that aren't on the roster for this series against the Astros, and they elected to have basically six starters.
Yeah.
When you look at it, you know, Price is coming out of the bullpen, so we know what's going on there. But you look at, you have Sale, you have Pomerantz, you have Porcello, you have Eduardo Rodriguez, and you have Doug Fister, who's going to start game three. If you had such a good bullpen, wouldn't you want more of those? Like, where's Brandon Workman? Where's Matt Barnes? And I know people laugh a little bit about Barnes. He's not great in high leverage situations, but to pitch in the sixth or the seventh, I'd rather have him out there than one of the starters. I just think it's odd that you have this really good bullpen that was a strength of your team, and then you decide you're going to have basically six starting pitchers on your postseason roster.
Yeah, it took them a long time to announce their playoff roster. It didn't come into the early afternoon before game one, and it made me wonder if they were really having significant debates about this guy, the either-or situations. I'm with you. Austin Maddox is on the playoff roster. He's a promising young pitcher, but he doesn't deserve to be on there in place of Matt Barnes.
Yeah, the sample size to me on Maddox, just not large enough. And speaking of Maddox, right, he gave up the third of the home runs that Jose Altuve hit in the game. And Jose Altuve, a little pint-sized second baseman with a Ruthian game.
Here's the 1-1. This ball's belted to left. That ball's got a chance. Make it three! Are you kidding me, Altuve? Three home runs!
They got to figure out how to get this guy out. The problem is nobody in the American League figured out how to do it this year.
Yeah, that's a great point on Altuve. I'll tell you what, I would feel better taking my chances with Brandon Workman getting him out than somebody like Maddox. I think there are some real questions
Barnes too
that I have about their postseason roster. Barnes as well. You're absolutely right. Those were the guys who helped get you here. Why would you not give them an opportunity to help you advance in the postseason? All right, Chad, thank you very much. As always, great baseball talk with you. All right, well, it's called winning ugly. That's exactly what the Patriots did on Thursday night against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. What do they need to focus on now that they have a little bit of time to rest? We've got some ideas after the break. We're back on Season Ticket. Now we're joined by Boston Globe Patriots beat writer Jim McBride. He's in Tampa following the Patriots' 19-14 victory over the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on Thursday night, and he joins us via Skype. Jim, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
Doing well. When I look at this win, Jim, I think that it was a win they obviously needed to move to 3-2. I would describe it as progress, but not perfection.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the defense made some great strides last night. The mood in the locker room was much better than it's been the last couple of weeks, but I think there's still a sense among the players that they've got a long way to go, but they made some progress last night.
Just how much progress did they make, Jim? Because when you look at it, the final numbers are somewhat similar to what they had been allowing. They came into the game ranked 32nd in the NFL, which is dead last, in yards allowed per game. It was more than 456 per game. They gave up 409 yards, and when you look at it, a lot of those yards came in the fourth quarter when they were trying to close out the game. 229 of them came in the fourth quarter when it really mattered. So did the Patriots players look at that and say, okay, you know, we didn't really close it out the way we wanted to? Or were they more focused on the first three quarters where they played pretty strong defense?
Yeah, that's what they were definitely accentuating the first three quarters and coming up with the stops that they needed to in key situations, which is something they really haven't been able to do the last 2 weeks against the Texans and Panthers. So I think it's kind of that typical New England defense for you saw for the first three quarters where it's they bend a little, but they don't break. I mean, they had a couple of key stops in the first quarter. They shut them out in the first quarter, which was the first time the Patriots hadn't given up points for nine straight quarters. So I think it was key for them to do that. I know they kind of went into that prevent mode in the fourth quarter and Jameis Winston got a little hot, but I think they were trying to accentuate the positives in that locker room last night. And I think communication was so much better in the secondary, and the fact that they went man a lot, I think it helped out not only Stephon Gilmore, but Malcolm Butler as well.
I agree with you on that. I think one thing they did do to simplify things was it was a lot of man defense, and it was literally like take your man. Stephon Gilmore spent a lot of time covering Mike Evans, the star wide receiver for the Buccaneers. They've simplified it to the point of just cover this guy, like just point at someone and say, Stephon, this is your guy. And I think that certainly helped a great deal for the defense. I've been accused in the past of being a little bit of a pessimist, Jim. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought this was improvement, but I also thought the Buccaneers had a lot to do with their own demise. I thought they were definitely complicit in their own demise, missing the three field goals.
31 yards, Tony.
Well, he's got to have this, right?
They've got to have it.
Oh.
And they don't.
Oh, my goodness.
I think the Patriots' defense was better, but I hope they don't get lulled into a false sense of security based on this performance.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, they definitely, I think, see this as a building block. Malcolm Butler and Stephon Gilmore talked after the game about how much better they felt out there and how much easier it was for him. I mean, Stephon Gilmore made no bones about the fact that he likes playing man. And they told him early in the week, you're going to be on Evans. And he said, he couldn't have been happier about that. And it certainly showed in his play I think he looked confident out there. You know, he didn't have any passes defense, but he really did a great job blanketing. And I think you take away those rerouting combinations for him that he was definitely having trouble grasping the first couple of weeks. I'm not saying he's not going to get it eventually, but I think those two corners, Butler and Gilmore, love playing man, and so they were so much more comfortable last night. And I think Devin McCourty and Hightower, your two big leaders, stepped up and had great games. I mean, Devin had 11 tackles. He seemed like he was everywhere, and Hightower was not only lining up on the edge as he's been all year, but he was back in his more familiar spot in the middle of the defense on certain downs. And I think his presence, really kind of calms everyone else down, and they look to him as a leader. And, you know, he didn't have huge stats last night, but he was a force.
That begs the question when you're talking about moving Hightower back into the middle primarily, which is something I advocated for, and playing the man defense in the secondary that the cornerbacks feel comfortable with and want to do. Was some of the defensive difficulty in the beginning, in the first four games, on the coaching staff? Were they maybe too stubborn in trying to be what Patriots teams had been in the past, which is a multiple variable defense, instead of just looking at the guys they have and saying, let's maximize what we have right here?
Yeah, I think they're definitely guilty of that. I mean, they know these guys' skill sets and what they're strong at, but I think they wanted to play a certain defense, especially these last 3 weeks where they were playing mobile quarterbacks, and sometimes zone defense is better when you have a guy like that can get out of the pocket, like Deshaun Watson, Cam Newton, Jameis Winston to a lesser extent. And I think they thought the best way to go was zone, but they had to scrap that after the Carolina game and get back to making it simple and playing to these guys' strengths. And clearly these guys are man-to-man guys.
Take me through that fourth quarter a little bit, because things there, I think, got a little tense for the Patriots. It seemed like they were in control of the game. But as I mentioned, 229 yards in the fourth quarter for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. What changed?
I just think that they kind of got away from what they had done in those first three quarters. And I think Jameis Winston had a lot to do with that. He got hot late. He had been, you know, really dreadful for most of the first half. And, you know, he started to heat up in the third quarter. And I think that kind of that gunslinger mentality in the fourth quarter plays to his strengths because, he's smart, you know. He just wasn't accurate last night. And, you know, I give him credit. He was the first person to stand up last night and say, look, your quarterback needs to make plays in the fourth quarter. And I didn't. He actually did. He just didn't make that final play, that final read on a play that really could have, you know, changed the outcome of the game. But, I think it was too they kind of played in that soft zone in the fourth quarter and kind of almost came back to haunt them. But, you know, they held on.
One play for the game. Three-man rush. You have a lot of time, James, to find a soft spot in the pocket.
And we got a big guy in Evans to the end zone. And it's incomplete. And the Patriots hold on for the victory.
Flipping it over to the offensive side of the ball, Jim. No Rob Gronkowski last night, obviously. Julian Edelman, as we know, is out for the year with the ACL. The takeaway for me on offense from the Patriots was once again Tom Brady taking some hits. This was a Tampa Bay Buccaneers team that came into the game last in the NFL in sacks. They got three of them last night and were credited with six quarterback hits.
Third and one and empty backfield. Brady feels the pocket collapsing and he is sacked for the second time.
How concerned are you about Tom Brady continuing to absorb this type of abuse?
Yeah, I think it's a big concern. You know, he's been sacked 16 times already this year, hit 32 times. And believe it, when I saw the 32 number, I thought that was kind of low. I thought he'd been hit more than that. But, you know, he's 40 years old. He took a couple of hits last night that I was really surprised at how quickly he bounced back from, especially a sack in the first quarter that he absorbed. And he looked like he was a little stung on the sideline. He was kind of rubbing his shoulder, his elbow. And I said, wow, this guy's taking too many hits. But, you know, the offensive line hasn't played great, hasn't protected him really great. Kind of a slow start for Nate Solder this year. Kind of a slow start for Marcus Cannon this year, who's coming off probably the best season of his career. So I think that's a big concern going forward. You just don't want, you know, you don't want a 20-year-old quarterback getting hit as much as Brady has, but he's 40. At some point, it's going to catch up to him, and I think they need to do more to shore that up. And certainly, you know, not having Gronk last night as an extra body to block hurt, and not having that quick receiver, Edelman, these guys have been his best receivers for the last 5 years, and certainly it's an adjustment period without them, and you know, I think Tom's taking the brunt of it right now.
All right, Jim, thanks for joining us from Tampa. We really appreciate it. Great stuff.
Thanks, Chris.
That's Patriots beat writer Jim McBride. Moving on, lest we forget, the Bruins were part of this triple header of Boston sports last night, and there was one rookie who quickly made his mark.
Bjork into the middle for Krejci, back to even straight. Jake DeBrusk is on the board! His first National Hockey League goal! The Bruins lead 2-1.
What was cool about Jake DeBrusk's goal was that his dad, Louis, was there to witness it, and Louis knows how hard it is to score an NHL goal. He played in the NHL. He was clearly overcome with emotion by his son's accomplishment. It left him in tears.
The tough guy sheds a tear. Your son makes the National Hockey League and scores in his NHL debut. Good for you, big man. That's a wonderful moment when the emotion comes leaking out your eyes.
The Bruins are back on the ice on Monday. That's October the 9th. They're going to take on the Colorado Avalanche. Finally, a segment we call the Cheap Seats, and frankly, the view from the Cheap Seats doesn't include seeing much of Rob Gronkowski, at least it did not on Thursday night against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Stop me if you've heard this before. Gronk was unavailable for the Patriots. Now, the Patriots have a mantra. It's that dependability is more important than ability. Nobody questions Gronk's ability, but his dependability is becoming a real question. Last year, the Patriots won the Super Bowl without him. Maybe it's no longer time to consider a backup plan for Gronk. Maybe having Gronk available is the backup plan. And that's it for this edition of Season Ticket. If you liked us, be sure to tell a friend. Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcast or Stitcher. To find out more about our podcast, go to wbur.org/seasonticket. And for more great sports stories, subscribe to the Boston Globe. Season Ticket is a production of WBUR Radio and the Boston Globe. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Gasper. Have a great weekend. We're back on Monday.